can't write a bill that only helps the people you like. It'll be used by the criminals.
Alaska lawmakers consider expanding the right to self-defense. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, racing a really long way on skis or by bike near Fairbanks.
Most of these people are crazy. 100 miles is a long ways. So, if you've never gone that far, it just seems very daunting.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
A state house bill that would expand the right to self-defense in Alaska has been getting increased attention, in part because of the Trayvon Martin case. Florida, where Martin was shot last month, passed a similar law in 2005. HB 80 would change the definition of when Alaskans can use deadly force. Currently, Alaska law says you can defend yourself if you're threatened or attacked in your home, business, at risk of being carjacked, or defending a child or family member, regardless of where you are, or if you're a police officer. HB 80 would drop the current requirement that in all circumstances, other than the home, business, or car, you have a duty to retreat if you can do so with complete safety. Anchorage prosecutor James Fayette, who testified against the proposal, says an unintended consequence could be an easier path for criminals.
I don't think anybody who supports this legislation for a second wants to help gang members. That's not what I'm saying at all. I just think it's an unintended, ironic consequence that this bill would then allow the gang guys to come to court and say, well, I was on the sidewalk. I have a right to be there. I didn't have any duty to walk away. And if you've ever seen one of these cases litigated in court, you see how easy it is for somebody that we would all agree is a criminal to come to court and claim self-defense.
Fayette works for the Anchorage District Attorney's Office, but stresses he's speaking out as a citizen and longtime prosecutor, not as a representative of the DA's office. Similar laws expanding the right to self-defense, such as Florida, where it's referred to as the Stand Your Ground statute, have been sponsored by the National Rifle Association. Republican Representative Mark Newman is from the Mat-Su Valley's Big Lake area. Newman says more than 20 states have now removed the duty to retreat. Newman says he is an NRA member, but that's not necessarily why he sponsored the legislation.
The fact remains that I just feel that people should have a right to protect themselves. You know, if you have rights while you're sitting in your home to protect you and your family, why should you not also have those rights when you're out walking down the street or camping or fishing? And, you know, why should you not continue to have those rights?
But James Fayette says the law does allow Alaskans to protect themselves or their family members now in the settings Newman describes. The standard is you must walk away if you can do so with complete safety. He says the duty to retreat is based on the premise that there are times when it's better for people to walk away rather than take a life.
Because self-defense is a powerful criminal defense, and when the jury is satisfied that someone acted in self-defense, the result is not guilty. It's not like, oh, okay, he's charged with murder, but maybe it's like self-defense, so we'll only convict him of manslaughter. It's not like that. The result is not guilty. It's very much a license to kill. That sounds very edgy, but that's exactly what this statute is. They're amending the statute that is the legal license to kill. And if the jury thinks that that's what happened, the result is not guilty. And people need to understand that.
Representative Newman says there are no changes made to the justification part of the current law. He says if you're a gang member or intoxicated, you can't claim self-defense. But Newman and Fayette both say almost all people who use deadly force claim self-defense in court. Newman says that's just the way it is.
That's why we have judges and juries and courtrooms that do that, and they can go through that court process and figure that out. Me as a guy sitting here trying to, on the sidelines, trying to second guess what's best or right or wrong, that's just not appropriate for me to do.
The bill has already passed the House. Senator Hollis French, a Democrat from Anchorage, said although he had concerns about the bill, he agreed to pass it out of the Judiciary Committee and send it to Senate Finance. A similar bill in Minnesota was vetoed recently. In the Florida case, the man who claimed self-defense and shot Trayvon Martin has not been charged with any crime. The senators working on a final version of a bill amending the tax on oil and gas today pressed the Parnell administration for reliable data justifying their proposed changes. Lawmakers don't have audited information to support the Parnell administration's claims about the law. Revenue Commissioner Brian Butcher told the Senate Finance Committee the data is difficult to retrieve.
We're dealing with years that companies have given the information to the department in the particular categories and subcategories that they have always done it, and it's not so easy to go after the fact and try to break it down into the kind of detail we would like.
The committee didn't want to hear of more delays in getting information relating to the oil taxes they're working on. The immediate questions concern the use of credits against taxes, specifically the incentives to encourage exploration. Co-chair Lyman Hoffman, a Democrat from Bethel, said he voted against the last tax change because information was lacking.
We're not talking about millions. We're talking about billions in the past, and we're talking about billions in the future. We need to be on top of this game, because those are our credits and we should know if they're working or not working, and it should be a very high priority.
And Bert Stedman, a Republican from Sitka, said the Senate's financial consultants have cautioned about the credits, saying they are too rich. He cites early estimates of work on existing fields that projected costs of about $60 million. He says that was off by about $2 billion. The Army's top general said last week that its leaders don't plan on making any major cuts in its forces in Alaska. Army Chief of Staff General Ray Odiero's responses to inquiries by Senator Lisa Murkowski come amidst federal budget-cutting efforts, and as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, uncertainty about Alaska's military future persists.
You can hear caveats in Odierno's answer to Murkowski's question during a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee hearing on Thursday.
Is it fair to conclude that the number of soldiers that are assigned to U.S. Army Alaska will generally be the same as it is today?
For the most part, it'll be very close to what it is today. Now, we'll continue to look at that, but our plan is not to do much changes to the forces that are in the Pacific.
Odierno's comments may provide a bit of relief for residents of the interior, where the military accounts for nearly a third of the region's economic activity. The Air Force's proposal last month to transfer a fighter squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson would take a big bite out of that economic pie, so the prospects of more cutbacks by the Army is worrisome, especially because the Army maintains a bigger presence in the state than the Air Force. But Odierno's comments help fill a void in information that UA President Pat Gamble says the Army has not yet provided in detail.
We've seen the Air Force's plan, and the Chief has been up here and talked to us and everything else, but his counterpart for the Army has not revealed what their plan is yet.
Gamble knows the process well. He's a retired four-star Air Force general who headed up the Alaskan Command and its higher headquarters, the Pacific Air Forces. Gamble says the Army, like the Air Force, also is wrestling with how to cut back enough to meet the big budget cuts mandated by President Obama as part of his administration's strategy to reduce the nation's enormous budget deficit.
So it's not just an Air Force issue. This reduction that's going on the national level is also affecting the Army.
The Pentagon's proposed 2013 budget of $524 billion calls for, among other things, the Army to cut some 80,000 troops in the coming years. Joe Ralston, another retired four-star general, says the military faces a big challenge in cutting such huge sums of money without damaging readiness. Ralston's career includes service as vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and, before that, NATO's Supreme Allied Commander. He now lives in Anchorage. He says the cuts are painful enough, but they'll be much worse if Congress fails to come up with a plan to cut the overall federal budget deficit by more than $2 trillion over the next decade. The automatic cuts, or sequestration of funds, are called for in the Budget Control Act, a measure that Congress came up with at the 11th hour last summer to resolve a standoff over raising the federal debt limit. The Budget Control Act calls for sequestration of $500 billion $1 billion from the Defense Department budget over 10 years, beginning next January, unless Congress can come up with a plan by the end of this year.
And the Defense Department takes a $500 billion cut and is looking at another $500 billion if sequestration kicks in. $1 trillion, you can't take $1 trillion out of the defense budget without closing installations.
Ralston says sequestration would devastate military readiness and inflict heavy economic pain.
If, in fact, sequestration kicks in on the 2nd of January, which is just a few months away, that's a catastrophe. And there's no question that you're going to see a huge number of base closures under that scenario.
This week, Congress will begin efforts at avoiding the sequestration hammer. The lawmakers will begin deliberations on Republican legislation introduced last week and a Democratic measure to be introduced this week, both of which seek to accomplish deficit reduction through the usual budget process. Given the present political climate and the pressures of an election year, agreement on either measure by Congress this session is uncertain at best. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage proposition that would fund a park for kids like Anna, who has a disability.
I really like playgrounds, and I like the seesaw.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
Alaska Native leaders from across the state were in Anchorage last week for a conference to address fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. They heard from birth mothers, young adults affected with FASD, and a number of people working to end the nation's leading preventable birth defect. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
One of the speakers at the conference was 19-year-old Morgan Fawcett. He says his mother's drinking during pregnancy led to his being born with numerous physical problems, including deformed hips, a cleft palate, and eyes that don't focus correctly. The average IQ is 100. He says his is 73. Fawcett says he's in constant pain from underdeveloped muscle mass and migraine headaches.
Disabilities that I struggle with every day, that my family struggles with every day. And it's always important that I point out that it's not just me that is affected by FASD. It's everybody in my life, my family, my friends, people I work with. Because everybody is affected by alcohol. Nobody is immune.
Fawcett says it's been hard to keep up in college, but he's making good grades. Lori Cropley is a former educator on FASD.
I drank when I was pregnant with my first child 40-some years ago, and I see the ramifications of that. They last four generations. Now my grandchildren have been affected by his disorder. And I'm trying just to become as educated and as supportive as I can, not only for my own family and grandchildren, but in the statewide Native community.
She says she would like to see a changed attitude among Alaska Natives about alcohol.
It once again becomes a part of the Native view and lifestyle that is not accepted, and that our Native leaders take vows to not drink while they're serving their people and in our own personal lives. I'd love to see that in our communities.
In 2000, the late Senator Ted Stevens garnered an appropriation of $29 million to address FASD in Alaska. Prevention Manager Diane Casto with the State Department of Health and Social Services says the resulting public education campaign helped cut rates among Alaska Natives by almost half, from 63 to 32 live births per 10,000, and overall rates by a third. But she says FASD rates among Alaska Natives are still high and on the rise among non-Natives. Casto says she's seen people deal with birth mothers harshly, and she'd like to see that change.
Alcoholism is a disease, and it is a crippling disease that takes over. And I think there's this attitude that women deliberately drink during pregnancy and they're deliberately harming their child. That's not the case. If they have the disease of alcoholism, they are struggling.
The conference was hosted by the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration's Center for Excellence. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
With the U.S. Supreme Court hearing oral arguments in the healthcare reform case this week, the debate over access to affordable insurance is in the news. A new PBS documentary airing on Alaska One Television tomorrow examines low-cost, quality healthcare in the United States. U.S. Healthcare, the Good News, finds that communities with the most affordable care have a system in place to cover the most people. It's by journalist T.R. Reid, who was in Alaska last week. KTOO's Casey Kelly has the story.
T.R. Reid's interest in healthcare came about when he was working as a Washington Post foreign correspondent in Tokyo and London in the 1980s and 90s. He and his wife were initially concerned about the quality of healthcare abroad. Their concerns quickly disappeared. In Japan, for example, Reid says you can tell just how important patient care is by the way the nurse calls your name in the waiting room.
The receptionist or the nurse comes out and says, Tomaso Rido-sama, irashaimasu ka? And that means, has the highly honorable Thomas Reid honored us with his presence today? Right away, you feel better.
Kidding aside, Reid's interest led to two PBS Frontline documentaries and a book about healthcare in the U.S. The first film, Sick Around the World, examined how other countries provide low-cost, quality care for every citizen. The second, Sick Around America, looked at people in the U.S. struggling to get and keep insurance. Around the time he completed the second film and book, Reid began to hear from viewers who wanted him to look at areas in the U.S. where good, affordable care is readily available.
And then PBS came to me and asked me if I would make that movie, Good, Reasonable Cost Healthcare in the United States. And I said, yeah, it sounds like a very good topic, but how do you find it?
It turns out researchers at Dartmouth College have been comparing Medicare billing records in communities across the United States for more than 20 years. In his new film, U.S. Healthcare, the Good News, Reid visits parts of the country where the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare says costs are the lowest.
And guess what? The low-cost counties have just as good results as the guys charging three times as much.
Reid says specific services, like a doctor's visit or surgery, cost pretty much the same no matter where you live. He says the biggest difference from one community to another has to do with efficiencies. For instance, a doctor in Miami, where healthcare costs are nearly twice the national average, will see a patient with high blood pressure once a month. In Seattle, where costs are below average, the same patient is seen once a year.
So you're paying 12 times in Miami for the treatment you would have gotten once in Seattle, and the system, our system, pays those bills.
Whether in the U.S. or abroad, Reid says he's never found a perfect healthcare system, but he says anything would be better than the patchwork system the U.S. has now. One thing he did find is that parts of the country with the best quality, lowest cost healthcare have doctors and hospital administrators willing to lead the way.
We met doctors all over the country in this film who said to us, I have an obligation to preserve the physical health of my patients, but I also have an obligation to preserve the fiscal health of my community.
Reid met with the board of directors for Juneau's city-owned Bartlett Regional Hospital last week. He also met with the board during a previous trip to the capital city, and Chairman Bob Storer says members are big fans of Reid's work. In recent years, Storer says the board has become more conscientious of rising health care costs.
There is a growing sensitivity that some of the procedures that we do offer at the hospital are well above alternatives in Seattle. We talk about that. We hope to be able to reduce those kinds of costs. It's not going to happen overnight.
Reed says the only sure way to get lower health care costs is to make sure everyone is covered. He says it's done in other first world countries, and on average, they spend about half of what the United States spends per capita on health care. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The State House today opened its week-long focus on education with an overview of what Alaska has done for local schools. Commissioner Mike Hanley told the Finance Committee that overall funding for local schools has consistently increased over the years. Lawmakers were interested in how the state will pay for the requirements being put on schools next year. The administration shows increases in contributions to retirement costs and to energy expenses and offers to pay for pupil transportation. But Dillingham Democrat Bryce Edgman said the whole issue rests on funding given to schools through the state's basic per-student formula.
We're not funding that to a high enough level to meet sort of those invisible bar charts that are there that could be attributed to the school districts. Everything from the school district of Anchorage being down $22 million this year to city of Dillingham being down $300,000 plus. I mean, it's across the entire board.
Commissioner Hanley disagrees with that assessment that funding has not increased. He said that 25% of the state's funding goes to education.
We don't see flat funding. We don't see flat spending. We see an increased cost. And I think people look at just the bottom part and don't recognize necessarily what the state actually is doing. And these are surely increased costs.
The committee will hear from local school board members tomorrow to get their take on how to provide sufficient funding. Among the propositions on the Anchorage municipal election ballot April 3rd is one that means a lot to one little girl. Her name is Anna, and she likes to go to the park. KSKA's Daisha Eaton explains how Proposition 3 could give her a place to play.
My name is Anna, and I'm 5.
And where do you live? Where are you from?
Anchorage.
That's Anna Bolts, a 5-year-old with big blue eyes and blonde curls. Like most kids her age, she loves to play, and among her favorite places is the park. But unlike most kids, Anna can't play just anywhere. Her mom, Leah, explains.
Anna has spina bifida, which is a birth defect where the spine does not completely close around the spinal column, and a section of the spinal column is outside of the body when they're born. She is paralyzed from the knees down. She can walk with the assistance of a walker. For longer distances, we use the wheelchair. We're just getting in the wheelchair, and this is pretty much what we do every time we come here. Luckily today, there's a path plowed out, so let's go walk down here.
Okay.
Anna's mom, Leah Bolts, pushes her wheelchair down the snowy path at Cuddy Park, just beside the Lusac Library in Midtown. Leah's been working on the Parks for All campaign since 2009 to bring a playground for kids of all abilities to Anchorage. Right now, there's no fully accessible playground in the city, but Leah's hoping there soon will be one at Cuddy. She points to an area that's covered with snow.
This area that we're walking by right here on the right is where the playground is supposed to be.
Underneath is grass, rocks, and shrubs. What Leah would like to see is
playground equipment and surfacing that allows children in wheelchairs and equipment that allows for any disability to be able to access it.
That means rubberized surfacing that wheelchairs can go on and ramps.
Access to the top of the equipment is a big thing. We go to the playground now and I lift her up on the slide and she comes down and I lift her up until I can't do it anymore. So this would bring us some ramps up to the top of the equipment where she would be able to wheel up on her own and get out of her chair and slide down.
Mayor Dan Sullivan has endorsed the idea and set aside some funding. Leah and other mothers have also raised a substantial portion of the necessary funds. The remaining $100,000 in funding for the playground is bundled into Proposition 3, the Parks and Recreation Bond on the upcoming municipal election ballot.
For little kids, really how they learn is through play.
That's Amy Simpson, the executive director of the Infant Learning Program in Anchorage. She says little kids with disabilities need a place to learn movement and interact with other kids.
But I also think that it's important for children without disabilities or who may be on a more typical developmental trajectory, that they have experience with individuals who are different from them, because that's what builds compassion in our community.
For Anna, the reasoning is much more simple.
I really like playgrounds, and I like the seesaw.
If Proposition 3 passes, Anna and an estimated 8,500 other kids with disabilities in Anchorage could finally have a place to play. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
50 competitors have completed the third annual White Mountains 100 north of Fairbanks. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, they set out early Sunday morning for the ultra-distance human-powered race. A handful of racers are still out on the trail.
Competitors waxed skis, filled the tires of their fat bikes, and tightened gaiters over their running shoes just before setting out on 100 miles of remote trail north of Fairbanks. Race director Ed Plum admits that this race isn't for everyone.
Yeah, most of these people are crazy. 100 miles is a long ways. If you've never gone that far, it just seems very daunting.
There was a healthy mix of rookies and veterans among the skiers, bikers, and runners competing. The majority of them hail from Alaska. 9 came from the lower 48. Plum says it's the perfect opportunity to see a part of the state not everyone knows about.
There's an excellent trail network that's maintained by the BLM, and there's cabins, at least for the race course, we have a checkpoint in a cabin about every 20 miles. So it's a great distance between checkpoints and nice warm little cabins and super scenic country.
A permit from the Bureau of Land Management limits the field to 65 racers. This year's competitors faced a challenging trail covered in at least an inch of fresh snow with spots of open water and heavy overflow. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Jacqueline Estes and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
A reminder from the Alaska Energy Authority. The 2012 Commercial Energy Audit Program application period ends Wednesday, March 28th at 4:30 p.m. Owners of eligible commercial buildings throughout Alaska, including nonprofits, may be reimbursed for a qualifying energy audit. Go to akenergyauthority.org to apply online. Energy efficiency is good for business. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.